Stark. I am joined here with Brandon Adamson. He is the author of A Beatnik Fascism. Brandon, it is great having you on the show.
Thank you for having me on the program.
And I'm also joined here with Alex von Goldstein.
It is great to be on this program with you guys.
Brandon, so tell us about your background and what are some of the issues that got you into the topic of beatnik fascism. I know the title, it's an interesting and provocative title, and it has a, it's also a reference to a Twilight Zone episode.
Well, I'm a longtime writer and blogger and a musician, and I wrote a poetry book back about 10 or 12 years ago called Side Quest, which didn't really have any specific theme or anything like that. Beatnik fascism, the idea from it, the idea came from actually a friend of mine was making a comment on this this old Twilight Zone episode, and he was like, gee, like, you know, the worst Twilight Zone episodes in the original series has to be the one where the beatnik aliens come to Earth. And I was like, oh, no, that one's great. Like, what are you talking about? But it gave me the idea that, you know, in that show, these aliens come and invade Earth, and they're kind of, they're disguised as these, like, beatnik biker types, and they talk like beatniks, and they're kind of outcast in their little town and society, and they're basically kind of secretly plotting to take over as part of this invasion force. And it got me to thinking, even though that was just like a part of the horrible, like, Hollywood exploitation caricature of the beats, it made me think about how, in today's society, like, just as in the beat movement, it was a lot of people who didn't really assimilate into the post-war, society of the 1950s and early 60s. The consumerism and everything of that era, like, they kind of were people who rejected all of that and did their own thing. Whereas you see a lot of these nationalists right now that kind of live as outcasts in the post-Cold War globalist society, that are just kind of on their own, doing their own free thing, sort of detached from popular culture and society.
The whole beatnik movement, it was in some ways a precursor to the hippie movement of the 60s, but would you say it was a lot more, like, organic as opposed to the hippie movement becoming a mass movement? Because in a sense, because it was a smaller movement, it was a lot more authentic and in some ways culturally elitist as opposed to a mass movement like that came later on in the mid to late 60s.
Yeah, I think, you know, that was something that always bothered people like Kerouac, because the original beats were not particularly ideological. It was more of kind of a pure movement about just kind of like, having the courage to, you know, go off and explore and do something different, than what was expected. And that kind of was...
Do you see a dialectic there between, like, hipsters and then social justice types in the mid-2000s?
Not so much. But I do see that, like, when that movement was kind of hijacked and latched onto by these people that made it more ideological, that was made it more militant, and it really made it political. Like, it wasn't something that was, I started out political. It was very very innocent, at that time, which, you know, maybe can relate to nowadays, but I don't know.
And then one thing you pointed out is that Jack Kerouac was accused of making racist comments, but there's kind of this concept of romantic racism, and a lot of the beatnik writers like Jack Kerouac and even Norman Mailer, they kind of were accused of putting on their fantasy into different minority groups like blacks. And in some ways, that's kind of like a precursor to this concept of like the ironic racism that you see with us hipsters, where you see social justice warriors accusing hipsters of being racist. Like, do you see a lot of parallels to that?
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, I just wanted to say that, like, I didn't, you know, write this book with the intention of saying that, like, claiming that these beat writers were actually fascist or something like that as some kind of revisionism. It's more of a sense of kind of, you know, channeling the spirit of their nonconformity. But at that same time, they were, if you look at all of these people now, back at that time, some of them were, you know, part of the civil rights movement and all of that. But, by today's standard, I mean, they would all be considered, white supremacists, even, you know, the Jewish ones, you know, like, Norman Mailer, and these other ones, because they're accused of essentially romantic racism, which is, you know, kind of exploring these other cultures and, appropriating, kind of like treating them like these exotic, pets that they're exploring and documenting their experiences, like hanging out with these natives, you know, in these different, parts of town, and just kind of, you know, this kind of romanticizing them in a way that's kind of exploiting them. I think Norman Mailer wrote an essay called, The White Negro or something like that, where he kind of romanticized all of these things about how he admired, you know, how free blacks were and how they just did what they wanted and whatever. But at the same time, like, they were perpetuating a lot of stereotypes. And even reading some of Kerouac's older stuff, I noticed that, you know, things in his books, like, they just wouldn't, you know, they would really piss people off now. Like, you know, parts that are just innocent where he's, like, you know, making fun of some foreigner's accent or something like that. But Kerouac did actually make a lot of anti-Semitic statements, and he, you know, was accused of anti-Semitism a lot. Even in the documentary, which is a good documentary, What Happened to Jack Kerouac, there's some interviews with Allen Ginsberg, you know, who was his, you know, good Jewish friend, and he was talking about how Kerouac always thought that there was, like, a Jewish conspiracy against him, you know, about all these people that were always coming after him and whatnot. And Ginsberg talks about Kerouac's many anti-Semitic statements and things like that. But I don't think that he really was. He mostly seemed very apolitical, and he was just mostly, from what I can gather, just kind of a reactionary Catholic type. You know, that was the best I can get from...
Do you identify more with the beatniks than you do with the sort of the traditional, like, American right, like the sort of, like, all these different right-wing groups in American history?
I completely do. I think that when, you know, a lot of, you know, conservatives kind of, you know, they love 1950s, culture and whatnot, whereas I actually identify more with the 1950s and 60s counterculture. Maybe until you get up to, like, the late 60s, where it just kind of gets really kind of dirty and trashy and grimy. But I think that the you know, that was just quite like an exciting group that were just, you know, I think that they're, you know, they weren't squares, as you'd say.
Well, I mean, it seems that there could be this element to people like Kerouac where they always kind of feel that they want to be the underdog. They want to be going against the kind of mindless masses. Do you see that in his work? Do you relate to that?
I do. I see, you know, a lot of that is just people who were, you know, really it could have almost been at any time, but just people who are really not satisfied with the status quo and just looking to go out and explore and find other things and, you know, and experience different things and reach, you know, higher levels of consciousness, you know, just kind of like when, and I kind of allude to this a little bit in my book in certain areas where just as they, back then, you know, they took like psychedelic drugs to try to heighten their consciousness and experience. Like you see, people doing things like that now with, getting into like transhumanism and that kind of thing, is another kind of version of that, which is interesting because, you know, Timothy Leary was vaguely tied, together with that crowd. And then he was an early, you know, futurist, transhumanist type.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, this is something, this is interesting because Robert and I have been talking about this idea of the green pill. And it seems like a lot of dissident movements start out with people trying to, like, escape the material world and try to heighten their consciousness and reach, sort of like create a new reality. And it's obvious that, you know, the beatniks were doing this. They were just trying to kind of go somewhere else. And, you mentioned psychedelic drugs before. Have psychedelic drugs played a role in your creative life? Or do you see that kind of correlation? Or do you see that these drugs create like a false enlightenment?
I don't really use them. You know, my drug experimenting was all, in high school, you know, and I had a couple of bad experiences, so I never, did them again. But I think that early on when people were using, those types of drugs, it was, they were, you know, trying to gain certain experiences or, you know, experiment with certain things. I think that, over time, all of that, you know, the innocence is completely gone from that, and it became something that, you know, not only was abused, but it also just became just another, you know, consumer-like marketable commodity. You know what I mean? Like, you even see that now with, like, these libertarians that are like, oh, you know, let's legalize all of these drugs and, like, think how much money we could make, like,
yeah,
going
yeah.
into business, you know? So...
So you make a lot of the comparisons to like who are the beatniks today and all these different like dissident movements, whether they're on one end you have like neo-fascists and race realists and nationalists, but then you also have like anti-consumerist and anti-corporate types. So just all these people who are kind of on the fringes outside of the mainstream society. And then even within different political movements, you have people who don't fit in within those movements. And you're someone who, and basically probably us as well, don't really fit in, are kind of outsiders within an outsider movement. Like you have, one example of that is you have the alternative right. And then within the alternative right, you have these different groups that don't fit in with that movement for different reasons. Maybe, like, one example of that would be, like, the alt-left and futurist.
Yeah, well, that's really what you find. And, I'll address the second point in a second. But what you have are these the people, you know, back then, who really wanted to go off and do their own thing, who rejected all of this kind of, you know, 1950s, you know, marketing, you know, kind of leave it to Beaver bullshit. And, you know, and like jock and leather jackets and all that stuff. Like, you had people who rejected all of that, and they were just like not quite susceptible to all of that, marketing and propaganda that was put towards them. And you have people now that are essentially on their own, and they're rejecting all of this, you know, politically correct propaganda that is like just bombarding them from every direction, like from at work and like, you know, diversity training at school and education, and through advertisements and through you know, television, the internet, you know, just even just logging into your email, you've got someone trying to push this stuff at you. You know, not only stupid products and movies and TV shows, but also this really politically correct and anti-white narrative that's just constantly bombarding people. And you have a certain segment of these people that are on their own, and they're not susceptible to it. And at the same time, they find themselves in these movements, and you know, I wrote a poem about that. It was called like a movement magnified, where it's like when you get in there and you look closer, then you see that like these people are alienated even within these movements. They're constantly fighting. You know, they all hate each other. You know, there's very little cohesion once you get, you know, to an outsider. It might look like the alt-right is like this monolithic group, but when you get in it, you realize that, like, you know, that they're constantly debating the same things. Tons of people hate each other. There's really, they can't agree on very much except for, you know, a few core people. It's just kind of an endless alienation that these people face.
Robert and I were talking about that on a show we did about conspiracy theories, and we basically said the same thing you said, where, you know, you have all these movements, and from the outside, people see it as being like, well, everyone who is, you know, maybe we think that everyone who is like an SJW type is the same way, but those people all probably hate each other more than any outsider who disagrees with them dislikes them. You know, it's like, I feel like, they say that the worst conflicts are brother wars and civil wars, and people that kind of agree with each other probably have more resentment for one another than people who completely disagree with one another.
Yeah, I mean, kind of like family feuds, for instance. But the way I see the alt-right is, and people use that word, like I'm alt-right, and you see, like, the Twitter hashtag alt-right. But it's not a specific coherent ideology. It's sort of a big tent movement for people who are outside of the mainstream and are basically a dissident and opposed to basically the way things are going. So within that movement, you have a extreme ideological diversity. You have an anarcho-capitalist. You have like a national communist. You have a radical traditionalist. You have a futurist. It's just it's one of the most extremely diverse movements. And I'm not opposed to the label alt-right per se, but the problem is if you put a label on the movement, you kind of pigeonhole it, and people say, oh, you're this label, you have to think a certain way. But it's sort of just a way of bringing people together who think outside the box.
I think that's true. The thing is when people talk about like a big tent movement, you know, when you get into alt-right, a lot of people don't even agree on like the core beliefs. And a lot of the things within the tent are like, they're not just variations of the same idea. A lot of them are just diametrically opposed. You know, they're like, you know, like you have people in there that are like pro-abortion and anti-abortion. Like it's just things, you have things that are just like so, you know, you have hardcore traditional Christians and, you know, atheists and pagans. Well, you know, people who believe those certain things, like, you know, those aren't really compatible, you know, within a group. So it's like when you get into these groups, like I did when I got involved in that, like I found that there were like, you know, there were people who took Alex Jones like seriously. And I was like, what? Like, are you fucking kidding me? Like, you know, but then it's always like you get in there and you meet and you're like, oh, these guys seem kind of good. And then somebody says something and you're like, whoa, like, you know, for me it would be like, yeah, like I, you know, I hate all these conspiracy theories. And someone would be like, yeah, so do
well,
I. But then they would tell
I
me.
I remember that
me, like,
before the alt-right got started, and that was basically the alt-right got started, I think it was about around 2012. Before that, you basically had two things. You had white nationalism, and then you had the conspiracy movement of, like, Alex Jones and David Icke. And then you basically had paleoconservatives like Pat Buchanan. And then those were kind of what existed before that.
Yeah, that's right. You had a mixture of these different groups, and they don't clash well together. But also beyond that, you know, things kind of changed after 2011 and 2012, whereas, like, you started to have a lot more, I guess, ordinary people that were interested in this kind of politics, because they had become alienated from the mainstream. And then when they get into this stuff, you know, you have all of this leftover kind of kooks, you know, that had been around before, that were just really just like genuine fringe types, you know.
From the message of the book that I get is that on one hand it is both ambitious about the future, but it's also a black pill in the sense that there is this kind of realization that most of us are on our own.
Yeah, like I present in a lot of these different, you know, poems, which, you know, when I say poems, like, I don't want people to get the idea that, like, I guess if you're not into poetry or anything, it doesn't mean that you wouldn't like this book, you know, because it's not, you know, there's ideas and things implemented in a way that's like, approachable for anyone, even if you're not into poetry or anything like that. But there's some, you know, creative ideas and stuff and optimism about the future. But at the same time, there's kind of like this realization that, you know, at the end of the day, like, we're still kind of on our own. Like, we don't really have any real movement to speak of, any cohesion, you know, nothing. In some of these places, like, you know, I live in a big city, but imagine if you live in a smaller area, like, you might be the only person in your city that even holds these kind of beliefs. Like, you're really on your own, and there's no one, you know, in that episode of The Twilight Zone, you know, where these aliens disguised as beatniks are part of this, like, large, like, you know, fascist, like, alien empire, and, you know, if it doesn't work out, you know, or something, like, they still have this whole empire to go back to. Like, we got nothing. You know what I mean? There's no place you can go to really escape any of this kind of stuff. It's not like, you know, a country like Poland or something is like, is going to be like, all right, you know, we're going to repatriate. We'll come in boats and pick up all you guys that want out of this. You know, it's just, there's really, there's no one there to save, so we're all kind of on our own.
With your book dealing with, does it touch upon issues of morality? Does it reject the sort of a traditional morality that you would kind of expect from conservatives and even the alt-right?
Yeah, a little bit. Because, you know, I'm not really a square, you know, so I'm not into, really any of that, traditional stuff. That's one, you know, one reason I identify more with the, you know, the beatniks is just cause, you know, I reject a lot of that, that square lifestyle. I think can be a real drag. You know, I'm very, like, open-minded about different kinds of, you know, culture and art and experiences and sexuality and things like that. Like, I'm not interested in going back to the
So do you feel like marriage, like, so what do you think about something like marriage?
I think marriage, if that's, you know, something that you're into, it's fine. I don't necessarily have this idea that these traditional people have that, like, we all need to go back to where the, everything was great, you know, in the 15th century and, you know, men and women were married and the women stayed at home and raised the children. Life is short, you know, and then you die. So I think people should, there are other ways of living life, you know, and being a productive person in society than being within this tiny box, you know, because it worked supposedly for some people, hundreds of years, you know, which, you know, these old societies, they weren't utopias, you know, they were, these countries were constantly at war, people died at young ages, you know, and I don't fetishize those time periods the way some people do.
How does your book explicitly address a lot of these issues, like dealing with morality and sex?
Well, it only addresses them subtly, because it's not like, this isn't a book where it just sort of lays out an ideology or something. It's just, they're just poems. So, within these experiences and whatnot, it just kind of addresses it in the sense of, you end up in these various situations and then it's like, what a drag.
It's kind of funny because you have this talk show host, Michael Savage, and he's very, like, right-wing, socially conservative, and homophobic. But when he was a young man, he swam naked with the beatnik poet Allen Ginsberg in, like, the South Pacific.
Yeah, well, who knows what happened.
Yeah. He was really involved with, like, herbs and medicine when he was younger. So they probably, you know, maybe they took some valerian root and who knows what happened.
I think you have, like, all these different, like, fascist and new right figures. I think their utopian society is just to create a world where it's, like, where, like, blonde teenagers can, like, skinny dip naked everywhere.
I mean, that definitely has an appeal to it, and... I mean, I'm not gay or anything, but I think that, like, there is a sense that the, I identify more with, like, the Roman world, you know, and a lot of the pre-Christian stuff that people hate. Actually, that was I was raised a Catholic, and it was only in school, like, in fifth and sixth grade when we started studying, like, Greek mythology and things like that I was just like, oh, like, I don't want to be Catholic anymore. Like, this world seems, like, so much cooler to me, like, the myths and everything. And I think I ended up having to, like, talk to, like, a counselor or a priest or something, because they were, like, upset that I was, like, I was getting into all of this other stuff. But I really identify more with that, where I like the pre-Christian, like, Roman era, like, even the stuff that everyone, like, the depraved stuff, like, Caligula era and all that. Like, I think that stuff, that's a way cooler, world, but that, that's just...
Oh, like, so you sort of like that kind of free sexuality?
What was that?
Like, that free sexuality? Something that is appealing to you?
What kind of sexuality?
Like a free sexuality, like sexual openness.
Oh, free. Yeah. I think so. I think that, like, what a lot of people want is, or at least what, what I find desirable is to, separate ourselves so that, we can live in the kind of free societies that we want to live in. And that's, freedom just isn't about doing whatever you want, but also living in the kind of society you want to live in. And some people who want to live in a very traditional society should be able to have those areas as well. But I think that, you know, as a, like a Westerners, we require ourselves to be separated in order to live in these free and open societies, because when you bring other people in, they're just not compatible with that kind of a lifestyle.
One of your poems is about going into an antique shop, and you express kind of your interest for Greco-Roman pre-Christian artifacts, but then you also talk about like retro-futurism and imagining the world as it could be. Were you inspired by our discussion we had on another show, or have you like been interested in retro-futurism for a long time?
I've always been interested in it. You know, in fact, I think I started writing that poem a few years ago and then kind of expanded on it. But really the idea behind that was that, you know, that going into an antique store isn't necessarily about just the past, you know, because that's what I said, like going to an antique store is like the closest I can get to traveling in time. You know, but it's not like you're just going, you can only go to the past, because you can find things in an antique store, even like a painting or something from the 1950s that's very modern, or an old, you know, science fiction painting or book or something like that, that actually depicts the future in a different way. So you can look at that and it can direct you towards a, like almost like an alternate timeline to a different future that maybe like people for whatever reason ended up not going that way and ended up doing all this other stuff. But you see that a lot when you look at old like you know, modern art and sci-fi type art from the, you know, 1940s to the 60s, is that they depicted the future a certain way, that we were going to do all of these great things and go these places, but then our society went in a different direction and became focused on all of these pointless wars, you know, in third world countries, and just bringing in you know, millions of people from the third world who had no desire to, you know, colonize the moon or anything like that. So they have so you can go and look at that stuff and you can say like, oh, you know, that's the future that we can still get to. So that's really what the point of that poem was, is that there are really alternate directions that you can go, and you can go to, you can look at history, or you can look at, go to an antique store or an old art gallery, and you can get, you can see visions of the future, not just the past.
Brandon, like you, I'm from an artistic background, so I'm very interested in things like culture and aesthetics. But that does connect with politics, because there's this kind of debate about the future versus the past. On one hand, there is people who talk about progress and the future, but obviously our society now is headed in the wrong direction and our culture is in decay. But then you have these like radical traditionalists and reactionaries who want to recreate the past, but that's always doomed to fail. There is a lot of stuff to get inspiration from the past about, but it doesn't inspire people to say, let's just create like the 1800s. I think you have to create something new and exciting. And that's basically what is exciting about retrofuturism, is it's something that has never been created.
Yeah, I think so. I think it also, what it does is it gives you, like I said, it gives you a chance to go on an alternate timeline and take a different path to the future, you know, because the one that we're going on isn't working out, but it's not like you're just going back to something that's already been tried. Another thing I wanted to mention is that when I look at this kind of stuff, and I don't know if other people do this, but I always kind of fantasize when you see this, like these old artifacts from different eras and stuff. Like I almost get this this fantasy of like wanting to go back in time and you know, and alter the the course of history or something. When you see these old Roman artifacts, like, I feel like, man, like, other people look at it and they just are like, oh, you know, it's a statue, but I see it and I think, like, wow, these were great times. Like, you know, I'm sorry, guys, like, I wish I could go back in time and, like, give you guys some, you know, laser guns or something so you could fight off the barbarians.
Alex, I sent you that clip from the film Scarface where they have this, like, a nightclub where it's, like, a retro-futurist, like, vaporwave Greco-Roman nightclub.
You see, yeah, there's the, yeah, it's crazy. It looks like a Macintosh Plus cover or something. But yeah, I mean, that's a weird thing. So it's like you're looking at, you know, this Roman architecture and you're seeing it yourself as being connected to it, as being part of like that linear path and just kind of wishing that you can jump on that path and slide down it and go, like, make a connection between now and then.
Yeah, and there's also, to me, there's this idea of time as being really like a non-linear, you know, which I've read some books and things like that, whereas like the human like perception of time that may be like limited by our understanding, and that you know, past, present, and future may be something that is like, it's all connected in a way that we don't understand. There was like a book from the early 20th century by one of the like a guy who invented like an early flying machine, who was like a really respected inventor, and he had this book that was about how when people, he had a theory that when people dream, because sometimes people would dream things that would happen in the future, that really like time was, you know, the past, present, and future were like, it was non-linear. And like when you dream, you're actually getting a mix of all of those in your mind because the perception has been altered. And I don't know if it's just like, you know, I don't think his hypothesis was necessarily true. I mean, it seems to me like kind of just a pseudoscience, but like a lot of pseudoscience, like the, it can, even if it's not true, it can still, you know, set fire to the imagination and give you ideas about how you can approach the future.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people do that. They know things to be untrue, but they still sort of continue with that in mind, thinking that the future will prove it differently. And I mean, in terms of a collective consciousness or proving linear time, that can be actually like a progressive thought. But in terms of other things, like if we just talk about, you know, our own nature as people and we deny that, I think that's an area where pseudoscience is really dangerous.
And there's also this kind of a debate between utopianism and the conspiracy theorist view. We've talked about this on our conspiracy theory at Greenpill show. Their view is that the elites are utopians, like the fascists and the communists. And then there's the whole sort of premise of liberal fascism, that the fascists are really leftists because they're utopians, and that the left has this kind of linear view of history. And that is true, that the left has a linear view of history. But at the same time, I think the big problem with our society is that we don't have any, like, grandiose visions. Everything is done in a very kind of a short time frame. Everything is about instant profits, and people just don't even think things through. They have no visions for the future whatsoever.
Yeah, I mean, even sometimes in their own lives, and that's kind of another you know, area of the book where, you know, someone who has these visions of like what society could be or whatnot, like they're, you know, there's nothing that they can do. They're on their own. Like they're in the middle of a diversity training seminar when they're trying to, you know, like when we should be you know, going to the moon and, you know, building condos on the moon, you know, or something like that. But it, so it's kind of this struggle that these people go through, because like you said, most people are just concerned with their, not even their own future, just their immediate business.
How they're perceived socially.
Just the stupidest stuff. Like, they're concerned about, like, a sports ball or something, like their football. It's just total, and that's, there was why I have a poem in there called, The Distracted Actors, which, says something. There's, I think, there's a line in there that I have at the end that, that says, our descendants will be defined, by our actions and our distractions, you know, because really it's what we're being distracted by that is going to affect what the future civilization is like.
So you have a poem called Barrelsville, and that's the beatnik term for Las Vegas. This one's about Las Vegas, and this also kind of ties in with a retro futurist.
Yeah, well, the title of the poem is Barrelsville 2292, and what the 2292 is actually a reference to this old beatnik comic that I found, because when I decided to write this book, I completely immersed myself in all kinds of like beat literature and documentaries, and even all of the exploitation like comedies and you know, books and movies and things like that. Like, it just as much of it as I could possibly absorb. And, the 2292 represents this comic that I thought was really entertaining. It was called The Hitman Wrinkle, and it was from from like the late 50s, early 60s, this comic book, which I paid like $25 for or something, just because I really wanted this. And in it, it's like the story of Rip Van Winkle, except in this case, it's like this beatnik in the 50s, the early 60s, who he falls asleep, and when he wakes up, he's in the future, the year 2292. And there's like these, you know, these futuristic, these beatniks in the future, and they're like, they think that he's like this square, you know, because like he writes his own poetry, whereas they have like a poetry machine, you know, where you just like push a button and it makes a love poem or this kind of poem or sad poem. And so I kind of took that concept to Las Vegas, where
Talk about the culture, just as kind of a like vapid, like a DJ culture that is amplified everywhere.
Yeah, and you know, that's a prime example of a place where you go to where you're just bombarded with marketing, like every step of the way. And you know, and then I also included the last portion of that poem is just kind of this odd vision I had for like a futuristic Las Vegas that really that wasn't filled with any of the logos or any of that bullshit, but was just kind of like this really clean, and these casinos and everything are all represented by these different colors, and the city was just built in this very kind of artistic, colorful fashion that was really you know, kind of beyond a lot of this this consumerist bullshit that has in some ways caused Las Vegas to kind of eat itself, whereas it also represented the kind of beauty of like nationalism and having a certain order of things that makes it you know, gives it its aesthetic and preserves.
The Las Vegas was sort of, in some ways, epitomizes capitalism and commercialism at its fullest, but there's also this whole other aspect of it about kind of creating this fantasy world where anything's possible. there's sort of the original Las Vegas, the vintage Las Vegas, which both of us are big fans of. And then there's, you talk about the newer casinos that lack any kind of specific identity. And then there's also kind of, this ties in with kind of like a retro futurism, like all these different like retro futurist ideas can provide fantasies, models for like a fantasy city. Like there's kind of the mid-century space age aesthetic. There's this sort of Italian futurist themed cities. There is like the 80s kind of vaporwave retro futurism, or you could have the sort of like Greco-Roman vaporwave theme, like that nightclub from Scarface, but like on a grandiose scale.
Yeah, and that really ties into the kind of the theme of the book, because you know, when I go to Las Vegas, despite the constant, you know, bombardment of all of this ghetto culture and just all of the like riffraff and trash and the constant like things that are being marketed to you, like I can still walk down that strip and tune all of that out and visualize something completely different, you know, and turn it into a completely different experience. And I think that that's kind of what, you know, what the book Beatnik Fascism is really all about, is these people that are, they're not absorbing, a lot of these things that are propagandized to them, or, you know, at them, really. And they're able to, whether they're at their job or in class or something, they're able to just, really just block all that stuff out and, pursue the vision of the kind of world that they want to live in. And in some ways, it may be impossible, but you never know.
Well, you know, visualization is a pretty interesting thing. And you know, you're a person who makes visual art as well. When you're writing these poems, do you visualize, like, do the images that, come to your mind when you create these poems, are they similar images to like your paintings? Is there like an aesthetic that runs through everything you do, or do you view these making music, making you know, art, writing? Are they different? Do they exist in different parts of your mind?
Well, what I really do when I write, especially poems or any kind of creative writing, I start out with like just a vague concept or like even just a sentence or something. And then as I write, like I go almost into like a meditative state where it's just like, I'm like completely detached and more immersed into something that I visualize, and you know, and then it's at a certain point I'm like done, and then I snap out of it and I think like, man, like, you know, where did I just go for like a few hours or something? But I can almost get into like a meditative state. That's why it's you know, I could, you know, start something like this at like 11 p.m. and I'll just go till 6 or 7 in the morning, because it will take me that long to snap out of it. And like, I know that if I don't finish it, it's not, you can't just dive back into this stuff and pick up where you left off. It just doesn't work that way.
As far as your general views on culture and aesthetics, do you think we should have a sort of free and open society where everyone should be open to express themselves artistically? Or do you think there should be a more sort of a rigid sense that there should be a dominant cultural aesthetic standard, and maybe not necessarily like censorship, but this standard is sort of seen as held up as superior to these other standards? What is your general outlook towards that?
Well, I like the idea of a lot of different small civilizations that have their own dominant culture. I like the idea of small countries and city states and things like that. I think that a certain a city or a country or something probably would have like a community sort of aesthetic because it really affects everyone, and if you have everyone just doing their own thing, then you end up with like almost like a junkyard or something. It just kind of, because when you mix it all together, it just looks like a pile of junk. But if it was all separate, then each is its own thing. And there are a lot of people who really hate mid-century modern art and architecture and all of that, and and I would hate to subject those people to have to be surrounded by it. I mean, they would be as alienated as as I am if I had to live in some small town in Texas and look at the the local aesthetic there. So I like the idea of different civilizations, and I think that there's even room for these different types of people to ally in order to get that if they can see past their own hatred for their other things people might be interested in.
And that's an interesting idea, because if you go to Europe, like each small country, despite like the European Union, has its own distinct culture and like an architectural aesthetic style that's evolved over centuries. Within, let's say, the United States, you could have like one country that's maybe specifically like a mid-century like space age aesthetic.
Yeah, exactly. And then people who hate that, when they would rather just live on like a on a Amish farm or something, like that, they should be able to have that too. They wouldn't have to live there. So I don't know. I think that that's a good idea. And then you do see that in Europe, at least. You used to. I don't know to what extent you still do, but you had different countries where people dressed differently, spoke different languages. The buildings looked different. The art looked different. And I think that that actually gives people more freedom in a sense, and it actually makes all of the areas look better than if you just had this all one globalism where basically everything just looks like shit.
I talked about this on the show Alex and I did with Keith Preston. He advocates like a pan-secessionism. And I think there's like this big misconceptionist that if you're a pan-secessionist, that you're like this radical like Luddite who thinks everyone should like live in like small like huts and grow their own food.
Yeah, well, I think those people do exist, and I think that's a problem, is that of these different groups, like, they can't work together to get their own society, because those people would hate people like us so much, like everything that we stand for, that like they're not even down to ally with people, where it's, I'd be fine to work together to get those people their own areas. Like, it would be great to let people who you don't agree with get their own areas, because then you don't have to deal with each other anymore.
Yeah, I feel like people like us are willing to compromise with people who don't think like us, and we actually want them to have the society that they desire, whereas they call us evil, and all they want to do is destroy us.
Right, and that goes back to when you get into the alt-right or something, like, you're perfectly willing to ally with, like, these radical traditionalists and whatever that are also upset about excessive political correctness and all of this other stuff, and you're willing to ignore some of these other things and be like, yeah, let's ally on these things. But at the same time, then they look back at you and they're like, oh, you know, you guys are degenerates, you know, like, you know, we don't want, well, it's like, okay, well, we're not allies then, but, you know, that's your choice, not mine. You're on your own, you know, like.
You wrote an article back in 2011 promoting Donald Trump as a dissident candidate. Can you talk about that article? If you still have a reference to it, that'd be great. But you told me earlier that you never got credit for that article.
Yeah, it actually kind of bothers me that I never get any credit for that because, you know, I wrote that article back in 2011, and I'll give you a link to it. You can post on your site. But I basically laid out all of the reasons why, you know, Trump would be a good alt-right candidate, you know, and that was even before most people weren't even using the terminology alt-right back in 2011. You know, but I wrote out there, and what gave me the idea to write it was that for years and years, like, we didn't have any candidate that was willing to limit immigration or enforce border laws, and he came out on a program and said that, like, he supported Arizona's SB 1070 law, which was like this controversial law that was passed that all of these other conservatives were like, you try to distance themselves from. You know, Jan Brewer signed it, of course, and that's why she's like a really hated person by these social justice types and a lot of the conservatives. But when I saw that Trump came out and defended it, and he's just like, yes, you know, if somebody asked me for my papers, like, I wouldn't mind, I would just show them, you know, or something like that, whatever he said.
Yeah, I mean, I remember that was really controversial in 2011, and this is before I was sort of thinking analytically, and, you know, just due to the nature of it and the media narrative, I was opposed to it, and I think I was at, like, Thanksgiving or something, and I had some cousins who lived in Arizona, and they all supported it. And, you know, I feel like that's the thing. It's like when you're exposed to these kind of environments, you have a different opinion than when you're, you know, kind of just living in your, you know, little social circle amongst, you know, I think you have to get what I mean there.
I definitely do. And, I wrote the article because I, you know, for years and years, the GOP never had we had all been wanting, you know, like, someone to vote for who was, like, opposed to increasing immigration, who was going to enforce border laws, and who was going to, you know, do something about the demographics, you know, pouring in from the third world. And when he seemed to be a person, I was like, well, if he ran, like, finally we would have someone to vote for, because before that we were always kind of having to vote for these people that, like, that really we just didn't, you know, even like Ron Paul in 2008 or whatever, you know, there was, you know, I would have liked to vote for one of the, you know, Democratic candidates, like Kucinich and some of these people, but they're all for open borders. All of the GOP was for open borders, except I think in 2008, like, Duncan Hunter wasn't, but he was like a no name. So
or Tom Tancredo was the other one, but they were both marginalized.
And he's
what's
a,
going
he's
on?
A, Tom Tancredo was a terrible speaker too.
And what's going on with Trump now is he's down in the polls. I think if he took a stronger, like, radical centrist message, he could win. But I think what's bringing him down, he feels that he has to appeal to all these conservatives.
I completely agree. He's been pandering to the wrong people. You know, he chose Mike Pence as VP, you know, who was this total conservative who was like a globalist, you know, interventionist, like free trade, like all just the worst of all worlds. And
I was listening to Richard Wollstonecraft talk about this, and he actually said that he thinks Trump chose Pence strategically to win Indiana. Because Indiana was, it's a state, it's like evangelical, he could easily lose it. And I think, you know, Wollstonecraft, actually, that argument kind of made sense to me.
I don't know, but I think he's going to win those elections, those states anyway, if they look at Hillary Clinton. I mean, those there's also the conservative is a kind of term I heard thrown around. There's another term like true con, which is to describe someone who's just concerned about social conservatism and economic conservatism. But those people, like, they may not like him, but eventually they're going to vote for him. He needs to be innovative. Like, if he chose someone like a Jim Webb, that could have pulled in all these independents, and he could have won states like Pennsylvania and Maine. But I think Trump has made a lot of mistakes. Yeah, Virginia, definitely.
Yeah, and also, I mean, let's not forget that these evangelicals all voted for him in the primary over Cruz. Like, he won South Carolina, you know, in all of these other states. He doesn't need to pander to, like, the religious right now that he's into the general election. Like, he should be going after these young people that are tied up in student loans and things like that. He should be going after the Bernie people. The lesson that he took Pence to kind of pander to all of these establishment conservatives, and it didn't work. They're just like piling on him now. Like, they can't they can't contain themselves trying to disavow him. Like, it didn't work. He should have just said, you know, he should have just. I always think that Trump is better when he just goes on his own instincts. Rather than telling people what he thinks they want to hear. That's my impression.
Trump wrote this book back in 2000, and he sounded very, like, centrist. He talked about, like, raising taxes on the ultra-wealthy to pay off the deficit. He's always been very socially moderate. He used to be pro-choice. Even recently, he talked about restoring a Glass-Steagall, which would be a huge step in the right direction. So if Trump could just be himself, I think he could win.
Well, this whole pro-choice thing, I've heard that it's, you know, he goes on this, like, thing, like, I was pro-choice, but then a friend of mine was going to have an abortion, but he decided to have the kid, and that's what made me pro-life. But I actually have heard that that's about his own son. That's like a rumor, you know, about Barron. So, I mean, I don't really believe that Donald Trump is as pro-life as he says. I just think that he can't really present himself as being pro-choice. But I agree with Brandon here. I think Donald Trump should just be himself, and his pandering to, you know, conservative, I think that's kind of really messing him up right now.
That's why it's so crucial to sort of create a new dissident movement instead of being kind of stuck in, like, the left-right paradigm and, like, a reactionary, like, right-wing politics. Before I wrap things up, Brandon, is there anything else you'd like to add up your book?
I just wanted to say that a lot of, like, we all need to support each other in these dissident movements, because we risk a lot to be involved in this stuff, and in a way, like, we shut ourselves out of the mass market and popular society. And so we really have to support each other. So, you should buy this book, even if it's something that, you know, you're not sure if you'd even be into, because we all have to support each other. Like, I've, you know, purchased a lot of weird books and stuff from other edgelord sites, you know, like Countercurrents and things like that, even if I just thought they were vaguely interesting, because we have to support each other. And a lot of people, you know, they waste money, going to see these crappy like comic book movies, and they're essentially like paying, you know, for cable and these things. They're actually paying to watch propaganda against themselves. They're funding people that hate them, you know? And people need to start thinking about that with things that they do. You know, when you go to a football game or something, you know, the money that you're spending is then getting, you know, funneled into these other, eventually somewhere down the line, it's going into these social justice causes and just various things that are opposed to you. So, you know, people should support other artists and writers in these dissident movements because, you know, we're not going to get the support from other places. And even if you're not into, like, poetry or anything like that, you can still get something out of this book, I think. So.
And since you brought up that topic, I'm linking to my artwork on my site, so go out and buy my work if you want to keep this show going.
I'm not selling anything.
You're only selling rare Pepes for like 20,000.
Yeah, That's under my. That's under my other account. Selling Pepes.
Sorry.
Yeah, well, I'm selling a Pepe. I'm selling a Pepe for $30,000. If anybody wants to just you know, send us an email on the site here, and maybe I'll give it to you. $30,000 though.
Brandon, it's been a great show. Thanks for being on.
Yeah, thanks for finally having me on.
That's all we have for today's show, so take care, and we'll be back with you next time.